Thank you very much. Actually, my main outlets these days are Truth Dig and Counterpunch. I want to be back with Telesur, but the U.S. government is blocking payments from its politics has to do with Venezuela, and just making it it's a real problem for writers. There's a lot of Telesur English writers, and we're having interference with our payments. And also Black Agenda Report and ZNet on occasion. So, you know, I grew up Southside, so I grew up in Comiskey Park, so, you know, I always kind of, I sort of always had the thought that if the Cubs ever win the World Series, then all hell will break loose. Well, you know, it kind of did. It's called Donald Trump. I confess, White Sox background, though I have, I always get sucked into the Cubs melodramas. I do. I did in 84, I did in 89, I did in 2003, the Bartman year, and of course I did this year, and I reveled in the Game 7 and all of that, but that's all over now because I found out that the Trump's Undersecretary of Commerce is the owner of the Chicago Cubs, so I don't have to worry about being a Cubs fan anymore. So here I am in my traditional December post-mortem on some god-awful American election. Typically, it's a congressional election. I'm sure I was here after the Tea Party election, right? And I'm sure I was here after the right-wing 2014 congressionals this time. Presidential. You know, you listen to the media in advance of this last election, and you would swear that the Republican Party was like on the verge of complete collapse and implosion. It was like all over for the GOP. And you know, it's like, hello. They now have all three branches of the federal government, right? The supposedly on its deathbed GOP. They have 34 of 50 gubernatorial seats in the United States. There are 25 states, there will be next year, where the GOP has both the governor's office and the legislature, okay? There will only be 5 states where the Democratic Party has both the governor's office and the legislature. This is really quite astonishing when you realize that the GOP is a widely hated institution in American life. It has an unfavorable rating of 62-63%. Less than a third of the country has a favorable opinion of the Republican Party. I mean, it's amazing. And yet they run all three. They're about to run all three branches of the federal government. I really don't think the electors, is it tomorrow, are going to not seat Donald Trump. Anything's possible. I didn't think Donald Trump was going to be elected. I believe all the pollsters, and he was. And, you know, so one of my questions is, what gives? What's this seeming anomaly all about? How do the Republicans rule a nation that hates it? How does the Republican Party rule a nation that hates it? And I want to speak with special reference to the recent presidential election. As I break down my answer, I'm sort of somewhat artificially breaking down my explanations between forces or factors that are mostly or significantly external to the Democrats, sort of things they could point at and say, it's not our fault, and then I'll want to focus in a little bit on some of the things that are their fault. Or maybe I should say also sort of some of the things that allegedly that have been done to them and that are external to them and that aren't that fault. Let me eliminate from the start some of the things that the external explanations, things that the Democratic Party could point to outside of themselves that they could blame for this horrible dilemma. And let me mention a few of them that I think are misleading and sort of false. The first one would be the Green Party and Jill Stein did it. Okay? Blame Ralph Nader or this time Jill Stein. Well, in the three contested states where there's been a recount, Michigan with 16 electoral college, Pennsylvania with 20, and Wisconsin with 10, in two of them, Michigan, Wisconsin, if you magically switched all of Jill Stein's votes to Hillary Clinton's votes. And there's a bad assumption there. Everybody who voted for Jill Stein would have voted otherwise for Hillary Clinton, right? They would have made a difference in those two states. Jill Stein did not have enough votes, even just on this magical assumption that they all would have been Hillary Clinton votes, to shift it to Hillary Clinton in Pennsylvania. I could get into all the technical aspects of that, but I think that would take us far afield. And even if the Jill Stein vote could have accounted for Trump's victory in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, all of that really begs the question of why so many, it begs the question of why the Democratic Party was incapable of defeating the incredibly unpopular and widely hailed Donald Trump in key contested states like Florida, Ohio, Pennsylvania is another one of them. Russia did it. This is incredible. I have never seen a media narrative just take off and become so pervasive in liberal America, so ubiquitous and so just, oh yeah, of course Russia did it. I mean, it's been practically overnight. It is just incredibly pervasive. I watched MSNBC this morning. I watched CNN this morning. I've been talking to some of my older sort of former new left, now liberal Hillary Obama types of Democrat friends, and they don't even give it a second thought. And you know, the thing about it that's just so absolutely extraordinary is that there is no actual real evidentiary smoking gun on the case. There are all kinds of problems, even on a basic evidentiary level, with the case. It's almost bizarre to think that the Russians would have so transparently, if they were the most sophisticated hackers in the global world political system right now, why in the name of God would they have left so many transparent markers? There's just no actual smoking gun chain of evidence that ties this to the Kremlin. I mean, we can talk about this maybe later in Q&A. Here are some of those remarkable things that strike me about this Russia did it narrative. One is how incredibly pervasive it is without evidence and despite counter evidence. Another thing about it that is remarkable to me is to see all kinds of liberals and liberal lefty types and progressives all of a sudden embracing and in love with the CIA. Because you know what the story is? Well, it's because the CIA says so. And they don't lie. I mean, it really is kind of like the telephone game. The CIA said so, and they told the New York Times, and they told the Washington Post, and they told the anchors at CNN and NBC and elsewhere. Because they said so. Because of the wonderful things he does. You know, we're off to see the wizard. Because the CIA doesn't lie, right? I mean, that's its whole institutional history is one of the arts and science of deception up through and since the invasion of Iraq and the false construction of a crisis with it. The third thing that strikes me about it is the chutzpah of people being outraged over on one country A interfering in the election of country B. I mean, nobody interferes with other nations' elections more than the United States. And it wasn't just a Cold War quirk. It wasn't just a sort of anachronistic, naughty thing we did because we were up against, you know, the great Satan, the Soviet Union. We have continued to be involved with and engage in systematic subversion of democratic processes all over the world. Latin American elections, African elections, Middle Eastern elections, and so forth, Honduras, up to the present day. A fourth thing that I noticed about it that really knocks me out is this sort of official cluelessness on why. I mean, insofar as Russia, I mean, I do think there was some kind of Russian involvement with WikiLeaks in association with the document dumps about the evilness of the DNC towards Bernie Sanders, you know, which kind of strikes me as doing us a public service, right? But this kind of official cluelessness about why Russia might have been motivated to interfere in the American electoral process on behalf of Donald Trump instead of Hillary Clinton, as if we can't talk honestly about the fact that Hillary Clinton, in alliance with Madeleine Albright and Zbigniew Brzezinski and the Council on Foreign Relations and a whole bunch of other TAP foreign policy, folks, was really part of a kind of warmongering, arch-NATO expansionist threat to the Russians. I mean, you could make the case that it was almost Russian intelligence operatives' national duty at some level to try and interfere in our electoral process, particularly given the fact that we've interfered in their electoral process in the past. And then there's this narrative that you hear directly from Hillary, and it's all over the media too, is this hideous, terrible, awful external attack on what? On our great democracy. But you don't even have to be a wild-eyed Marxist radical like me anymore to know that the United States is and has been for many decades a sort of transparent, open corporate oligarchy, a plutocracy, regardless of which party or whatever the party balance is in Washington. The lion's share of policy decisions go against majority progressive public opinion on most issues that matter in Washington and in the state capitals, and go in the way that business wants them to. And there's quantitative research about this by leading liberal, establishment liberal political scientists like Martin Gillens of Princeton University, and I can't remember his first name, Page, at Northwestern University. They have very high-profile studies out there. So, you know, what is this great democracy that big, bad, evil Vlad and the dastardly Kremlin are undermining? Now, you know, so it strikes me why I'm going off on this more than I ought to, this Russia hacking thing, but that's because I made the mistake of watching a lot of TV last night and this morning. I admit, I didn't realize how pervasive it was. It's really taken over the news cycle. Why is it being pursued so religiously and intensely in the absence of an actual evidentiary slam dunk smoking gun? Well, I think there's a number of things going on. I think it's sort of just too irresistible to the Democratic Party right now. They just can't let go of it. Even if it's not true, even if they're really not going to get the electors to make a different vote, I think that's tomorrow, isn't it, in the state capitol, Monday. Even, I think there is an attempt to make that happen. And like I say, I don't pretend to predict anything anymore since I thought Hillary was going to beat Trump. But even if they're not going to get that, and I really don't think Obama's been sitting down with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the congressional chiefs and the Supreme Court and talking about suspending the current election and holding... What are we going to hold a substitute election on the first Tuesday in February or March of 2017? And yet, I think the narrative will persist because it's too useful, and it's too useful in a number of ways. One is the Democrats want to use it for partisan advantage and to delegitimize Trump in subsequent electoral politics and in policy debates in Washington. I think that a key part of the foreign policy establishment, bipartisan, Republican and Democratic alike, is really concerned that Trump is too close to Putin and is going to stand back from the new Cold War that all kinds of military-industrial complex interests are heavily invested in vis-a-vis Russia. So it's a way of keeping the heat on Moscow after Trump gets in there, and I think they're going to find that irresistible. So you're going to hear about the Russia hacked thing forever. And there's also a my dog ate my homework aspect to blaming the election on external Russian influence. It's not that we suck, the Democrats. It's not that we, you know, it's not that we're a right-wing corporate neoliberal party beholden to the nation's unelected and interrelated dictatorships of money and empire. It's not that we abandon the working class and the causes of social justice and peace decades ago, right? Back beyond the Clintons. You know, probably you could, Ralph Nader dates it to the Carter administration. No, it's none of that, you see. We don't really have to change. It's a way of avoiding a confrontation with the right-wing Wall Street captive party that they've become, right? So it's a way of keeping forces of reform internal to their own party at bay. Just lame. Russia. Anyway, enough about the Russian hacking thing. What did I start with? You can't really blame the Green Party. The numbers don't add up. The blame Russia thing is bizarre, and yet it's going to be pervasive for these. Here's another thing I think not to blame. There was a big, nasty, mean uprising of vicious, white, sexist, racist, nativist, bigoted, working class Americans, those that Hillary Clinton so famously called a basket of deplorables. I mean, do you think that's going to be under people's Christmas trees this year? Did anyone ask for a basket of deplorables for Christmas? There was no big Rust Belt rebellion of the white working class. It didn't actually happen. It is a kind of pervasive, I've been picking that up too, watching TV lately. It is a kind of pervasive narrative. Trump's working class support is way, way oversold in media, you know. And of course, has anyone else here gotten irritated about how much the white working class and the working class have become conflated with one another, as if there aren't millions of African American and Latino and other ethnic groups in the working class? But it's way overstated. The real story is that the GOP got its usual share of whites without college degrees and whites below 50K a year. But Democrats lost those voters to non-voting. The Democrats' loss of such voters, white working class voters, and you know, we don't have a precise exit poll category called working class, so without college degree or 50K and less are your usual stands-in. Democrats' loss of such voters was three times Republicans' gain of such voters between 2012 and 2016. And by the way, one thing that exit poll data shows to me beyond the shadow of a doubt is that Bernie Sanders would in all likelihood have been able to defeat Donald Trump, I mean, in the absence of shenanigans around vote counts that frankly don't have anything to do with Russia at all. There's a whole history of problems with how votes are counted that Greg Palast and who's that Green Party guy in Ohio, Bob Fritakis, the expert on how the voting machines are set up. We didn't need Russia to have to intervene somehow automatically to have issues with how votes are tabulated. Now, you know, one external factor that I don't think is just the dog ate my homework for the Democrats is the Comey thing. Now, that really was an absolutely remarkable thing. The James Comey, there's by tradition been a 60-day rule that federal law enforcement does not say anything prejudicial towards a presidential candidate. You know, I think it's a 60-day rule, you know, leading up to the election. That kind of vague thing that Comey did, where he said, wait a minute, no, maybe there is a problem, without any real evidentiary substance. You know, the Democrats are trying to do with the CIA thing about the Russians, kind of what the Republicans did to what Hillary threw Comey, right? No smoking gun, not entirely clear exactly what we're talking about. I think that might have mattered. I think that Comey thing might have mattered. I don't know if it mattered so much with the popular vote per se as it mattered with it was kind of a signal, maybe even to the establishment, that Hillary Clinton was just going to be too flawed a candidate to get the establishment agenda through. You know, and I keep wondering if all these guys are talking about everyone's talking about the Russian interference. Are they looking at Comey? I mean, if really that's your thesis, that Russia did it, did they somehow infect the brain of the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation? The real thing is the internal causes at the heart of inside the Democratic Party, if you ask me. And I guess I already said it. Didn't I already just have a rant about the Democratic Party, which is a corporate, neoliberal, right-wing? What do I call them in Counterpunch all the time? The dismal dollar Dems. The dismal, demobilizing, depressing dollar Democrats. What the late, great Princeton political scientist Sheldon Wallin used to refer to as the inauthentic opposition party, you know, sort of the pretend opposition party. They do it every time. They do it every time. They kind of slip in because something terrible into the presidential to the White House because something terrible happens to the Republicans, like Watergate, so Carter can slip in. The recession and just the awfulness of George Bush Sr. and then also the Ross Perot presidency didn't help. I mean, the Ross presidency candidacy didn't help, and Clinton can slip in. The Great Recession, the financial meltdown, and the horrific invasion of Iraq under George W. Bush, Obama can kind of slip in. Well, then they get in there, and they do what Democrats do in the neoliberal era, which is serve their corporate paymasters, and then they wonder why they can't get the turnout that they need to win the midterm congressional elections. And the next one through. I was kind of surprised Obama survived 2012. But again, you kind of just had this classic Republican screw-up with Romney, who's just so hideously, obviously, like Central Hollywood casting Uber one percenter and saying idiotic things like 40% of the population are a bunch of, you know, welfare cheats and so on and so forth. You know, and I think that's the honest answer to what happens to the Democrats if they were really telling the truth about what's wrong with them. I want to mention some other external factors that matter and that are for real besides Comey. One of them was the polls. I was fooled by the polls. If I had had any instinct, and I voted in a contested state for Jill Stein, and if there was any chance I was going to be persuaded to follow Noam Chomsky's advice and, you know, do lesser evil voting in a contested state. And, you know, I wouldn't rule that out completely because I had a sense of Trump as a kind of quasi-fascist. You know, that was blown away by what I trusted the polls. They were, everybody, just about all of them were calling an absolute Hillary Clinton mandate. And I do think that created a false sense of comfort for the Democratic Party and contributed to their loss. I think, you know, another thing that made Trump's victory likely is there's this kind of thing, what I've called on Truth Dig, change rotation. We live in a neoliberal era where a president of neither party can really answer his constituents' needs, right? Because it's a global economy. It's a corporate-controlled economy. They pull the strings behind the scenes. It's a corporate oligarchy. And anybody, any president comes in making promises, populist-sounding promises to the people. The Democrats do it in one particular kind of way, more multicultural. The Republicans do it in a meaner kind of white nationalist way, appealing to the heartland voters. But they both kind of play this game of manipulating populism. And when they get in the neoliberal era, I mean, the New Deal era is long gone. The era of the sit-down strikers and the organized working class and great civil rights movements and all that, they disappoint their constituencies every time. And in that sense, it was kind of the time. It was kind of a turn for a partisan switch. It kind of reminds me of how the World Series, every year, it was a switch. American League had home field advantage in the World Series. National League had home field advantage in the World Series. Every year, just switched. Back and forth. Now they do this idiotic bullshit where the home field advantage in the World Series is who wins an exhibition game called the All-Star Game? That's absurd. But in any event, that's how it used to be. Well, in that sense, Trump was just kind of lucky. It was that a Democrat had just had two terms being unable to answer constituents' needs. Kind of like Obama came in after a Republican had just had two terms being unable in the neoliberal era to answer the constituents' needs. Now, Trump had the added benefit of actually sort of being an outsider. Obama got deceptively to pose as an outsider in 07, 08. He really wasn't, but he got to pose that way. Well, Trump even actually could say he was thoroughly outside the political class. And he had this kind of way about him, too, where he wouldn't do teleprompters and he would just talk off the cuff. And a certain number of voters actually liked that, and it didn't matter how many terrible or awful or vicious things he said or did. It almost got to the point, like, the more he just went off like a lunatic, it worked to his advantage. Low turnout is a problem in all American elections. American turnout is absurdly low compared to other countries, and that has to do with a number of things, one of them which is it's such an oligarchy that people get depressed and they don't see any point in voting. And the Democrats are always challenged with that because turnout is lowest among lower income voters. And the Democrats always have this real battle with turnout. I think that was a factor. Trump, here's another factor. Trump didn't run. You know, part of how does a party that is hated win a presidential election? I mean, people don't like the free market, transparently business-oriented capitalist ideology of the GOP. Well, part of the answer with Trump is he didn't run as a traditional Democrat. I mean, as a traditional Republican. He posed as this kind of populist. He beat up on NAFTA. He beat up on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He railed against companies that shut down jobs in the U.S. and sent them to other countries. He sort of stole Democratic issues. So that's part of the issue. I think another thing that worked to Trump's advantage, and always tends to work to Republicans' advantage, is our elections aren't really about policy. They're marketing campaigns about character and infantile aspects of personality. And policy is pushed horrifically to the margins in the American electoral process. And I think that tends to work against the Democrats. I mean, if we really had elections about policy, the Green Party would win the elections. They actually have the most popular actual policy agenda every year. But if we really had elections about that were mainly about policy instead of like competing brands of toothpaste, you know, Ford versus Chevy, or pharmaceuticals, you know, it's not very likely that a majority of voters would pick the rightmost of the two capitalist parties. They would tend to align more with them. But they're not. I mean, they're really, it's absurd how much they're not. And in fact, in all three of the, when I say not, they're not about policy. And in all three of the presidential debates between Hillary and Obama, there wasn't a single question asked about climate change. Not even once. The Electoral College. Yes, it favors the GOP. We know that. It gives disproportionate representation to smaller, Republican-leaning, red states. But I don't go very far in giving Hillary a lot of credit for being screwed by the Electoral College. The Electoral College is the rules of the game going into the contest, and everybody knew it. If you're playing baseball, I keep coming back to baseball today, if you're playing in Fenway Park, you're not going to hit line drive home runs to left field. They're going to bounce off the wall and be singles because they have that crazy green monster out there. I mean, if you're playing basketball in a gymnasium where the rims are 9.5 feet instead of 10 feet, you have to adjust your shot. It's called the rules of the arena. It's ridiculous. The NHL arenas all used to be different. Like the Boston Garden had this massive space behind the goalie, which is how Bobby Orr could get this big charge going up before he had these big charges down the ice. Well, you structure your strategy. You play in a certain kind of way associated with that kind of thing. Electoral College is part of the rules of the game. The Democratic Party knew it. They had no business losing Ohio, no business losing Florida, no business losing Pennsylvania to a widely hated neo-fascist type of right-wing freak. And they wouldn't have if they'd run somebody like Bernie Sanders. The other thing about Electoral College is we knew about it in 2000. We know about it at previous times in American history. The Electoral College has decided the election against the popular vote 5 times. Didn't do a goddamn thing about it. Didn't even make any initiatives against it after Bush v. Gore in 2000. I mean, that's a real issue. You know, we ought to do something about the Electoral College. It's like a profoundly, explicitly so authoritarian overhang from the founding fathers in the late 18th century. We didn't say boo about it. No one said anything about it since, certainly on the Democratic Party. There is legislation out there at the state level to make, you don't have a constitutional amendment about it, you can forget about it. The Republicans will defeat it. It's impossible to do a constitutional amendment. There is some legislation at the state level that would make, for states to sign on with making their electors go with who won the national popular majority vote. I actually support that. Gerrymandering is a very big factor why the Republicans can hold the House and also a lot of state districts. the estimates I've seen of the Democratic Party, because of the way the districts are drawn, and they're drawn at the state level, which means now they're drawn primarily by Republicans, the Democrats would have to win about 60% of the popular vote for the House of Representatives to actually take over a majority in the House of Representatives. The Democrats, because of the gerrymandering and voter suppression by Republican-controlled electoral institutions in contested states, the Democrats do. I'm sorry, I hate to be making excuses for them because they're such an awful right-wing party, but they really do have to have these kind of like sweeping, you know, electoral mandates. 51% doesn't do it for the Democrats because of gerrymandering and because of voter suppression and even because of hijinks with the tabulation of the votes in places like Ohio, North Carolina, and so forth, and also voter suppression. But none of that should be taken to mean that ultimately the Democrats don't bear significant responsibility for what happens to them by virtue of being such an awful neoliberal right-wing corporatist and imperialist party. Bad candidates, too. If you're going to be bad, wooden, stiff, unimpressive, shitty, boring, depressing candidates, if you're going to be a right-wing, corporate, neoliberal, imperialist party, you know, owned by the unelected dictatorships of money and empire, then you, and posing as a populist friend of the working class and minorities and so forth, then you better sure as hell have some, like, really charismatic types of candidates to paper over the contradictions, to help you paper them over, right? Bill Clinton had that. I don't like Bill Clinton. I loathe Bill Clinton. I think he's evil on like 18 different levels. But there was a, he had a magical kind of stump speech persona. There really was something about Bill Clinton that was kind of incredible, speaking wise. I haven't really seen a campaign speaker that good except for John Edwards in Iowa in 2007. Obama, I never quite got because I was alienated from him from day one because I knew him from Chicago, Springfield in Chicago because that Urban League job that you were mentioning before. But apparently he really did have a kind of telegenic cool and charisma. I got to give Obama credit for comic timing at the National Correspondents' Dinner every year. There was something, I hate to admit it, kind of cool and charismatic about Obama. But those guys were the anomalies. I mean, think about these candidates the Democrats have run in the neoliberal era. I mean, are you kidding me? Michael Dukakis? Al Gore? Walter Mondale? Windsurfer John Kerry? And, you know, even Jimmy Carter was a dullard, but he just couldn't lose because of Watergate. And Hillary Clinton is about as bad a campaigner as I've ever seen. And you got to realize I'm in Iowa, so I see these candidates more than I really need to see presidential candidates. She was horrific in 07 and 08. You know, they had no business running her. And her power-mad, power-lust insanity, just insisting on being the presidential candidate, to me, is just absolutely shameful. You know, I think there's a role of the left, so-called, in electing Donald Trump and in defeating Democrats, too. And one of those roles is just this insistent, tired, constant, again and again, nauseating, once every 4 years counsel from leading left luminaries to practice lesser evil voting. Which I noticed this time, just people just got, it just couldn't take with a lot of young leftists. They just couldn't listen to it, and a lot of older leftists couldn't take it anymore. And one of the problems with it, in my opinion, okay, and I've made the argument for lesser evil voting in the past. I've actually done it on at least one occasion. I tried it out for windsurfer John Kerry because it was the first time I ever voted in contested state in my life, and I was so freaked out by W's invasion of Iraq. I just thought I'd give it a try. So I've done it myself, and I've made the case for that. One of the problems with it is that it incentivizes the Democrats to be awful once every 4 years. It becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, why should they stop being terrible, horrible, awful, corporate, neoliberal, imperialists when they know that once every 4 years, Noam Chomsky and other left luminaries are going to be there to catch their electoral back and are going to be ready to ride on the back of that Harley, you know, roared by the Democrats with their arms around the Democratic candidate. Yeah, right, muttering and pissed off and not happy, you know, but they're still riding on the back of that bike, you know, with their nose averted so they don't have to smell who they're riding around with. And it just becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. So why should the Democratic Party be any different? You know, and then the Democratic Party is so bad that it opens the barn door for the Republicans to win the next time around. And the Republican Party gets, as the Democratic Party gets further right, the Republican Party gets further right, and the Republican Party gets so awful that left luminaries go, oh my God, look how awful the Republican Party is. And it just never ends. It's just like this vicious circle. It's like this endless descent into hell and the self-fulfilling prophecy. I think the other thing, when we buy into electoralism and this deadly definition of politics, right, that Chomsky has written about quite brilliantly, right, this horrible definition of politics as we go in a voting booth, and he's against this, by the way. You know, we go in a voting booth once every 4 years, and we mark a ballot, and then we go home and let other people run the world. I always say let rich bastards run the world into the ground. Or I put an I into the word run and say ruin the world. And that's literally happening now with the Trump administration, going to happen with the Trump administration. So many of us have, especially liberals I know, have bought into that dominant definition of politics, that there's none of that street heat, that thunder on the left, that social movement pressure to make the Democratic Party be any better, and to be the type of party that might actually not lose election. You know, so one interesting thing to me looking at this election is, as I go through all these sort of factors that sort of all came together, some of them are new and some of them are different, and a lot of them are sort of the same old, you know. Issues are devalued relative to personalities, change rotation every 4, every 8 years. You know, the Democratic Party is a corporate neoliberal party and always sort of fails, and that opens the door for the Republican. I mean, go on with these factors I listed, gerrymandering and all of that. Why did so many of us pick Hillary Clinton to win the 2016 election? Well, and I did. I'm guilty of that. I don't know many people on the left who didn't. I mean, I just sort of assumed. And like I said, I might have thought differently about what to do with the vote in Iowa. Probably not. But I might have thought differently if I hadn't believed these polls. That's the first answer. I just answered my question. We believe the polls. This is what the polls said. I mean, the New York Times infamously had Hillary at 85% likelihood the day before the election. The New York Times. And it was the same across the board. Was it? That was one crazy but it wasn't crazy. Outlier poll was the USC Los Angeles Times poll. They were actually sort of picking Trump. Well, they were honest. Well, I think that's the first answer. We believe the polls. Won't do that again. Not going to do that again. I think the other thing is we just couldn't process in our minds that someone as viciously, megalomaniacally, neo-fascist, sexist, just plain awful, I mean dystopian, like sort of something out of 1984 and Brave New World and Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death and, you know, and Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here. I mean, just, you know, name your dystopian political novels. We just didn't want to deal with the reality. We couldn't process that somebody as just f***ing god-awful as Donald, I'm sorry if that has to come off of YouTube, as Donald Trump could actually be elected president. We naively just couldn't process it. I remember my wife has this kind of funny thing she does when she's mad at you or somebody. You're not just dumb. You're the dumbest person who ever lived. Or like, oh, he's the worst asshole that ever lived. And I remember a few years ago we were all sitting, some friends were sitting around, and I was making fun of her habit of doing that. And we said, well, actually, you know, that's an interesting topic. We said, who is the biggest role in the world. And, you know, I always have this thing about Maury Povich, and I think Maury Povich is an absolutely horrible thing. You know, and then other people mention various, you know, dictators and, you know, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. The consensus that a lot of people came to was Donald Trump. When you think about it, I mean, who's the single worst human being, unjustifiably sucking up oxygen on planet Earth? And, the winner was Donald Trump. And I just don't think we could process the biggest call on the planet becoming the president of the United States. So what do we have with Donald Trump right now? Well, obviously, we have total and open betrayal and mockery of all these populist pretenses. I mean, he said all these populist things here. I mean, my God, these aren't just rich appointees in his cabinet. They're the richest of the richest. See, Trump seems to want direct rule by the financial and corporate elite. He doesn't want any of those managerial intermediaries like Lawrence Summers and Timothy Geithner. No, we're going to go straight to some of the leading vulture capitalists in the world. These are very parasitic capitalists who profited from other people's distress. I think of this thing as what is shaping up as a war cabinet. Obviously, it's a class war cabinet. I mean, we should just call the Labor Department the Department of Capitalist Labor Exploitation. Right? Puzder, a fast food, what was he, Hardee's CEO, an open opponent of an increase in minimum wage, obviously a union hater. I mean, one of the funny things about him is he's historically been an advocate of cheap migrant labor. You know, how does that work with the Donald's nativist, promise to build a wall against immigrants? I mean, the EPA... the environmental appointments, I mean, it should be called the Department of Environmental, the Department of Ecocide, right? Scott Pruitt, the Attorney General from Oklahoma, who's actually spent his career suing the EPA. He's in the EPA to destroy the EPA. You know, this bumbling moron and Texas hyper-fossil fuel uber petrocapitalist Rick Perry, the guy who he's naming the various departments in the 2012 debate he wanted to get rid of, you know, and I can't remember all the ones he said.
Two out of three.
He said, and there's one other I want to get rid of. I can't remember it right now. And then they told him later, you want to get rid of the energy department. That's right, I want to get rid of the energy department. It truly is an ecocide. I mean, these environmental appointments, you know, really strike me as a full green light to the full-bore greenhouse gassing to death of life on planet Earth. This is a death knell for the species if these people are allowed to go all the way through with their agenda. So we have war on labor, war on workers, war on livable ecology. The Supreme Court appointment that's going to come in is going to be part of war on women and reproductive health. The Attorney General appointment is a war on Black Lives Matter. It's a war on civil liberties. I mean, I could go on and on and on. It's also a war cabinet, I believe, in an actual military kind of sense, with Mad Dog Mattis and Flynn in there. Yes, there may be some breathing space for a while on Russia. There does appear to be a stand back from the war that it seemed like Hillary wanted to have with Putin and the Kremlin. But these people and Trump himself are warmongers about China and about Iran. And the contradiction of being so anti-Iranian and claiming not to want to collaborate with Russia is not going to go away. That's going to be an ongoing issue in the Trump administration because Russia and Tehran have all kinds of connections with another. And, of course, Trump has said just absurdly reckless things about nuclear weapons and how other countries like Saudi Arabia, you know, it wouldn't be so bad if they had nuclear weapons. He said things that seem to suggest that he doesn't see why we can't use small-scale tactical nuclear weapons in certain environments. So anybody who's telling you, like from the left, that now all of this was a great victory for peace and now we have a pro-peace candidate in there really needs to be told to think twice about this. Another thing that's really extraordinary about these appointments is how weak on government experience they are. I mean, typically, cabinets tend to be filled up by a bunch of people who have a lot of history with an elaborate think tank network in and around Washington, Council on Foreign Relations, Institute for Strategic Studies, Center for American Progress, blah, blah, blah. and tended to have had government appointments at some point. They've rotated into the public sector, rotated back out. I mean, that's what it is. It's a revolving door. But these people seem to have less of that public sector rotation than any cabinet we will have ever seen. There's something going on with Trump. I think it's almost kind of a form of a social Darwinism. He thinks that the... He really kind of worships. There's a kind of gospel of wealth around Trump. You know, he went to that church when he was a kid with Norman Vincent Peale and the gospel of wealth. There really is this kind of sense that the richest of the rich are sort of social Darwinian sense superior and need to be running the country directly, right? You know, John Jay, the founding father, the people who own the country ought to run it. And he ain't interested in just people who manage it. He wants, you know, actual owners in there, which could be a real problem for him. You know, the thing that stands out to me most about this most dangerous of all, about this multiply dangerous transition team is the environmentalists. Are there any silver linings in Trump coming in? I mean, you want to be careful talking to people, okay? When you sound like, I mean, there's this narrative that I pick it up on Counterpunch. Certain of my fellow writers of Counterpunch, like that, almost like gleeful, like excited that Trump is in the White House. This weird kind of, you know, backlash theory. I've never been a backlash theorist. I've always kind of thought it's useful to have Democrats in power because at least in the White House, because at one level, it's complicated, but at one level it illustrates the bipartisan nature of the system. I notice that every time a Republican's in the White House, it just feeds this narrative, right? What's wrong with the country? Well, what's wrong with the country is there's a Republican in the White House. And so then everything needs to supposedly get sucked into a big get-out-the-vote program for, what's it going to be in 2020? Cory Booker? You know, Elizabeth Warren's too old. I don't think Sanders is coming back, obviously. I mean, I suppose they've got these other folks. So let's be clear. The phrase silver lining means, I looked it up, the worst events or situations have some positive aspects. I think you got to be clear talking to people about this, particularly minority people, people that are going to be in Trump's target sites, that you understand that this is an absolutely horrible event. This is an absolutely terrible situation. I mean, if you look happy, the Trump won, God help you. I mean, I think that's just going to be a problem in organizing. I really, really do. But okay, let's get over that. Let's not celebrate it. Are there any silver linings? Well, yeah, sure. This is already shaping up as an unbelievably corrupt presidency that's going to just be plagued by corruption scandals. It also is going into the White House with the lowest popularity ratings of any incoming president ever, so you don't have to, you know, when you criticize Trump and you organize against Trump and you take on Trump, you're going to have a lot of people out there that are going to be ready to not defend him. And by the way, the notion that there was this huge white working class uprising for Trump and the whole working, quote unquote, working class, which by the way isn't all white, is all like behind Donald. It's just not true. That's a media myth. So you really don't have to worry about that. There's going to be an incompetence and a related arrogance issue around this administration. They're going to screw up the management of American state capitalism and imperialism. They're going to screw it up. Now, that can be dangerous. That can also be an opportunity. You know, Trump is this thin-skinned megalomaniac that needs to surround himself with sycophantic people who he doesn't like anybody. I bet you some of you have had a boss like this at least one time in your career, right? He doesn't want to get any negative flack from anybody. That's a problem. And that's going to be a really big problem for their functionality. There's an absurdity around Donald, to the biggest asshole on earth becoming the president. You know, I mean, I wrote a book about Obama, which I was really worried about him in 2010, which called The Empire's New Clothes. The way this sophisticated, smooth-talking, teleprompterized, post-racial, first black president, sort of just by virtue of his color and his coolness and his sophistication, kind of gave the American empire corporate system a kind of dangerous rebranding and made it look more progressive than it really is. You know, Trump, in a way, he's a nakedly ugly, and I'm not referencing that statue that went up in New York City, but he's you've got a naked, ugly, brutish ass clown of a president right now, and it's really absurd. It's absurd. And I think at some level we want to work with that absurdity. We want to extend that absurdity. There's absurdity everywhere. Most of our workplaces are absurd. The power structures of this country are absurd. I mean, embrace absurdity. I mean, this is supposed to be the most revered, powerful democratic institution in the world, and it's absurd, right? I'm not being clear on this, but I think there's some absurdity to work with in Trump. The empire has no clue. There are going to be no shortage of issues to work with for organizers in the Trump era. I mean, it's just one after another. Standing Rock is going to be alive and well. It's going to be this huge thing going on next year when the weather starts to warm up. I have the distinct impression that the Trump administration is going to try and declare the water protectors and the pipeline fighters economic terrorists. I wouldn't surprise me to see Black Lives Matter designated as some kind of terrorist and the Department of Homeland Security unleashed on them. There could well be in the next year or two all kinds of opportunities to protect immigrants, somewhat on the model of people in the northern cities protecting fugitive slaves. In the 1850s, there's going to be a lot of sanctuary city stuff. There's going to be a lot of immigrant rights activists. There's going to be no shortage of issues. Trump's going to ignite a fire under liberal and progressive butts in ways that unfortunately, presidents just don't seem to do. I mean, it really pisses me off, and it's really sad, the way a Democrat in the White House, a teleprompterized Harvard Law or Yale Law educated president, and Hillary would have been Yale Law, by the way. That's one step up from Harvard Law from Obama. The way they tend to put a lot of liberals and progressives to sleep. And I'll tell you, I'm in a bright blue liberal campus town, Iowa City. It's just classic. It's like Barack Obama's favorite town. Fill in the blank. Urbana-Champaign, Madison, Ann Arbor, whatever. People are talking about politics and direct action, not just electoral politics and protest, in ways they only do when there's a Republican in the White House. And they just do it when there's a Democrat in the White House. And I would say don't mock people because they were too acquiescent under Obama or under Bill Clinton. It is a fact. A lot of people can't seem to do a goddamn thing unless they're a Republican in the White House. Work with it. Work with it. And help build a movement that can't just be co-opted into a get-out-the-vote for Cory Booker in 2020 forward. Another silver lining is the delegitimization of the neoliberal Democrats. I mean, good grief. I mean, they're going to scream about the Greens. Well, actually, Jill Stein headed that off a little bit by doing the recount thing, right? A little bit. She's leading the recount. They can't scream about the Greens. We're going to scream about the Russians forever, but that will fade. There's going to be a lot of space for progressives to work with about these ass clowns atop the Democratic Party and how they... I spoke at a thing right after Trump was elected at a protest, and when I was done, I walked right up to the guy who's the chief of staff for the Clintonite Democratic Party progressive in Iowa City, David Lobsek, who's got to be the most boring, depressing, dismal Dem that ever lived. He took $5,000 from the Energy Transfer Partners that does the Dakota Access Pipeline. I walked right up to him. He knows exactly who I am, too. And every time I walk to him, he says, "What's your name?" And he tries to shake my hand. I said, "You know my name." I said, "How does it feel to have just handed over all three branches of the federal government to fascists?" And I don't really think they're all fascists, but I use it for effect, And we're going to have to face these people down. They have to be delegitimized. Our old blue dog's going to learn new tricks. Don't hold your breath. Nancy Pelosi is back as the House Minority Leader. I mean, the pathetic AFL-CIO couldn't even get behind this sort of semi-progressive pro-labor guy, Tim Ryan from Ohio. Wouldn't this be time to have a pro-union Heartland congressman, right? Be your next Speaker of the House or be your House Minority Leader? No, brought back Nancy Pelosi. The new Senate Minority Leader? Is it Elizabeth Warren? Is it Bernie Sanders? Is it even, who's that guy in Ohio? Is it even Sherrod Brown? No, it's Charles Neoliberal Dismal Dollar Dem Schumer, a Wall Street New York senator. Look for them to destroy Keith Ellison, a Bernie Sanders progressive, as head of Democratic National Committee. Don't be surprised, Chicagoans, if you end up seeing Rahm Emanuel as the head of the Democratic National Committee one day in the not-so-distant future, because, you know, he wants to get the hell out of here, right? I mean, this hasn't worked out too good for him. And, you know, he's got a track record on some of that kind of inside politics, you know, back in 06 and 08. It's an ugly track record because he funneled all the money to right-wing Democrats instead of anti-war Democrats. So I want to mention a few narratives to avoid going forward in this new age of Trump. Some of them I've already mentioned. There was a big racist, nativist, white working class obsession. No, not really. There wasn't. You don't have to worry about that so much. The Trump working class white vote was pretty much the standard Republican white working class vote. Most white working class people are not just horrible Trumpians. Don't go with that in there. Russia did it. Come on. You know, don't put up with that from your friends and relatives. I mean, don't ruin your Christmas over it either, but come on. The Dems will do a great progressive makeover of themselves in the wake of this ass-kicking they got from Donald Trump. They have no choice. They're just going to magically wake up and see that Bernie would have won, and they're just going to hand everything over to more leftist reformist elements within their party. Really? No. Hillary did her job. I mean, mark my words. Hillary would have preferred besting Bernie in the primaries and losing to Trump in the general. She would prefer that scenario to losing to Bernie in the primaries and Bernie winning the general election. I can't prove it, obviously, but I feel very confident in that statement. That's their job. The mainstream top, the people still in charge of the Democratic Party. First and foremost, it's to destroy progressives in their own ranks. That's one thing that really leaped out of the WikiLeaks data dumps, right? Public service, you know, by Vladimir Putin. Don't get me wrong. I hope they do. I hope if we're not going to have third parties in this country, and the Constitution is incredibly hostile, and the setup is very hostile to third parties. Well, then I would hope they would make themselves over, but I'm not holding my breath. Avoid this narrative. You can't oppose Trump if you didn't oppose Obama. Get over it. It is irritating that people are too acquiescent with Democrats in. But now that you got Trump in there, it's a new game. He's the president now, okay? I was relentless towards George W. Bush. I don't, just because I hate the dismal dollar Democrats doesn't mean I give Republicans a free pass either. Work with it. Work with the resistance against Donald Trump and try and make it the kind of resistance that can't just be hijacked by Democratic Party electorate. There still is something kind of left and populist about Trump. No, there isn't. Don't ever think there is. Don't fall for that. I mean, it's amazing how many, some of my fellow writers in Counterpunch seem to think there's like something really genuinely anti-war, genuinely populist in Trump. I would be careful about the narrative. Here's another narrative to be careful about. The establishment hates Trump. Really? Finance capital is like water in the basement. It just kind of runs to power, whoever it is. He's making damn sure to put Goldman Sachs, this is his Goldman Sachs in intensive presidency as ever. The Financial Services Roundtable is picking up the transition team expenses. Bank of America, Goldman, and the other stocks are having a bull run. They've been having a field day ever since Trump got in. They're willing to work with him. I mean, I think there's some issues. I think that it's not all going to go away. Ultimately, he may become unuseful to them. Don't get me wrong. But right now, they're going to do a honeymoon. And why shouldn't they? He is promising significant direct financial, environmental deregulation, and significant personal and corporate tax reductions. Trump is anti-war. Well, I already did that. No, he isn't. We're probably less likely to have a war with Russia than we would have with Hillary right now. But we're just going to double down on conflicts with Iran, and there's all kinds of issues coming up with China, which is also a nuclear power, and so on and so forth. Here's another narrative to avoid. All resistance to Trump is funded by George Soros and MoveOn.org. You know, some is going to be. Some has been already. Some is going to be. I mean, if George Soros wants to write me a big fat check, you know, I'll put my information up for direct deposit in my bank, with just the understanding I'm going to do a goddamn thing he tells me, right? But people are going to have all kinds of everyday, organic, rank-and-file, direct, social, historical reasons and experiences that are going to lead them to be angry at Trump and to fight against Trump. They don't need George Soros to make him angry against Trump. Okay, pipeline fighters facing off against militarized police as Trump comes to privatize Indian reservations in 2017 and 2018 don't need George Soros to make them angry at Donald Trump. Immigrants, you know, fighting against, you know, INS roundups and deportations don't need MoveOn.org. I mean, so beware of the people who, you know, I'm somewhat suspicious of Our Revolution by Bernie Sanders. I really don't know entirely what to make of it. I have a feeling that, you know, I mean, so it's a balancing act. But don't just assume. It just becomes this way of being passive. Here's another narrative, my last narrative for avoiding. I'm hearing this a lot now, that the what happened to Hillary Clinton shows that we should avoid and reject anything and everything related to identity, okay, of race, of gender, of ethnicity, and sexual orientation. Well, I would be very careful about that. Bernie Sanders has kind of said sort of things like that sort of suggests. I'd be very careful about rejecting identity politics briefly. There's a debased and bourgeois and corporate neoliberal version of identity politics, and there's a left progressive socialist version of dealing with identity, right? And the left has always worked with the specific experience and oppression of specific groups who, yes, are divided. And there's a whole divide and rule system under capitalism. But it isn't about squelching the specificity of black oppression or the specificity of immigrant oppression or the specificity of Latino aggression or oppression or gay oppression or transgendered oppression. You need to talk truth about what's specific and real about what's happening to subgroups so they can see their experience and identity on the solidaristic banner. I say work with identity in a way that gets you to class solidarity. Now, I also have this thing that may be related to that, this idea, is when you're talking to white working class people as an organizer, as a friend, I don't know, as a family member or whatever, it's just someone you're trying to talk to someone down from the neo-fascist Trumpian cliff of hell. I don't think when you're dealing with issues of race and ethnicity, I don't find it's very useful these days to appeal very much to conscience, you know, and to sort of lecturing them about how privileged they are. Let me tell you something. Someone working 10 hours a day in a meatpacking plant in Columbus Junction, Iowa, you know, dealing with carpal tunnel syndrome and, you know, and like 1 month's wages away from not being able to meet their rent or their mortgage appointment, or that, you know, mortgage appointment, payment, doesn't feel, for some pretty good reasons, particularly privileged, right? I think with race and ethnicity, I mean, this has been my experience. You talk honestly about the reality of other people's experience, but you appeal above all not so much to conscience or the sense that they're privileged as self-interest. Say, look, you guys have been getting played again and again and again by the master class, by divide and conquer. They do everything that they can to make other lesser, more marginalized groups the scapegoats, the reason for your experience. I mean, really, it's Procter & Gamble workers. It's not the Sudanese and the Congolese who are fleeing from, by the way, U.S.-sponsored imperial devastation in Central Africa, who are the real root of your oppression. It's the owners of the Procter & Gamble plant, who is a Fortune 25 plant, whose CEO makes hundreds of millions of dollars a year. If you want to move forward, you're going to have any chance to move forward increasing your wages, you're going to have to learn how to share your experience with these people. You don't have to become fully fluent in French or Arabic. You know, you could just learn a couple, two things, like how to say ça va, comment allez-vous, and begin some discussions about things that we're all experiencing, whatever our race and ethnicity might be. You know, going forward, building a left resistance, and one of the reasons I don't shy away too much for calling the Trump administration kind of neo-fascistic or using the F word with regard to them, is that it really, there's a few reasons I do that. I am not, really, if we were moving into a fascist era, the jackbooted thugs would be crashing through the store right now and beating the hell out of all of us, okay? There's not going to be an out-and-out, flat-out dictatorship. They're not going to overthrow all aspects of bourgeois parliamentarianism, bourgeois law, okay? They're not going to rally tens of millions of jackbooted petty bourgeois Americaners, you know, to invade Canada or Mexico. Trump might have a kind of thin-skinned, megalomaniacal personality. Don't get me wrong. I mean, he probably wouldn't mind being a fascist dictator in another context situation. A terror attack would scare me now about real fascism in this country to some degree, certainly with regard to the Muslim population in this country and the kind of things that they might be facing. So, I mean, it's classically, historically, it's not fascist. But I don't shy away from the F word completely with Trump because there's enough overlaps to be not okay, okay? White nationalist, nativist overlaps, militarist, hyper-masculinist, even the thin-skinned thing and the megalomaniacal personalities that overlap with fascism. I don't shy away from the F word in part because it underlines the gravity of this situation. This is no normal la-di-da, same as it ever was Republican administration. This is a really scary deal here. And all attempts to normalize it and make it seem okay, and, oh, it'll be all right, the Democrats will get their together, blah, 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 it needs to be militantly resisted. And I mean, sort of playing around with how it might be fascist, I think sort of underlies that sense of urgency. The sense of urgency, you know. You don't fight fascism with an electoral campaign 4 years down the road, right? You don't. I don't think Trump can be fought, particularly on the issue of the environment, which, I mean, literally this could be a death knell for the species if they go full bore with the petro-capitalist agenda, the greenhouse gassing. By the way, greenhouse gassing to death of life on Earth promises to be a crime that makes the Nazis look like second-rate criminals, right? Well, you don't fight fascism with an electoral campaign 4 years down the road. You fight it right now. You build a resistance right now. The other thing I like about using the word fascism, at least to some degree in a cautious kind of way, is it underlines the special historical role of the left, which is to lead resistance and build movements in ways that, quite frankly, privileged liberals, elite liberals, just never do. Okay, so that was kind of a segue about why I say I don't completely shy away from the word. Going forward, some ideas. Remember, again, I can't say this enough, there is no great, white, huge, gigantic tsunami of working class Trumpian sentiment out there. It's been way overblown. You don't have to run away and be scared of everyone in the white working class. But by the way, you do need to be sensitive to the fact that the white working class has got some class issues. They never see one percenters in their life. Most of their issues and the people they deal with are in the managerial and the professional elite. You want to know what's going on with white working class people? That's who rubs their faces in the dirt every day, by the way, is the managerial class. Well, none of us ever see one percenters, ever. Or very rarely. The only working class people ever really see one percenters are like the people who work in really fancy restaurants and clubs, right? Or work in their mansions or hotels like in Aspen, you know, and all of that. Do not forget, be confident. This guy's got low popularity. You don't have to worry about this son of a bitch. People hate him. They hate Donald Trump. Fear. I wish liberals and progressives would have as much chutzpah as the right, you know, and just you know, I mean, I hate to say man up, right? Get all hyper-masculinist like Donald Trump. But there's a whininess And what passes for left culture in this country is like, oh, that's not good. You mean Trump's going to do that? I mean, you know, well, the Republicans, they don't screw around. Can you imagine if this situation was reversed right now with the Electoral College and the charge of Russian hacking? Good grief, they'd be shutting this place down. They'd just be going absolutely, wreaking havoc and going absolutely nothing. Fear tends to paralyze. We have this huge chutzpah deficit. We tend to be too afraid and we tend to grumble too much. Mock this jerk. I mean, Trump, for Christ's sakes. He's absurd. The emperor has no clothes. He's ridiculous. Identity matters. It's not everything. Don't subordinate class politics to identity politics. Combine them. Make them work dialectically with one another. Work through issues of identity towards class solidarity. Like historically, the left, when we had a left in this country, and the last time we really had a through, thick and thin, durable left, which wasn't just about this demo here or that march there, was the Communist Party. And I'm not a big fan of the Communist Party back in the 1930s and the 1940s. That's what the old left did. They worked with race in a way that was consistent with class solidarity. Standing Rock went from a struggle against environmental racism to a struggle to keep all fossil fuels in the ground. And people who go up there say there are all kinds of interesting discussions about everything now, including class. And a lot of the activists up there, Native American activists, have very sophisticated thoughts about the needs of working class people like pipeline workers. We need to, and in fact they say we do, talk to them about what a big, huge, renewable green jobs program would look like so that they could. That's one of the things that drove me crazy, a lot of the Iowa actions against Dakota Access Pipeline. I had to struggle with my fellow activists to get them to not just hate the pipeline workers. Well, for Christ's sakes, you know, they need jobs. They need better jobs than the ones they got. Talk to people about why politics matters. If they're going to get a real reminder now in the Trump era, as just one assault after another comes after them. If you're trying to organizing or leafleting like I did recently, I helped leaflet against some of the banks in Iowa City that are investing in the Dakota Access Pipeline. The main barrier you run into is not opposition. It's indifference. There are just millions and millions and millions of people who are just sitting out politics all together. And you really need to connect with them about why politics matters. By the way, when I say connect with them, not just on the internet, on the bus ride in when I came in, it was just last night, it was just amazing to me, especially the younger generation. Every atomized individual sitting there with that glowing smartphone. I was in Cuba two Aprils ago, and I was just amazed at and I barely have Spanish, how unbelievably engaged, just on the street, people were with another, in restaurants, in hotels, everywhere, constantly engaged. And I got out of the United States long enough, it was 5 days, that I became desensitized to America a little bit. What am I trying to say? I became resensitized to how unbelievably mediated everything is now through electronic media. I mean, it just hit me right in the face. The minute I landed in O'Hare and got on the CTA, everything, I have to have real conversations with real people. Fear doesn't work. Fear tends to shut people down. That's one of the problems with the climate narrative. It just gets scarier and scarier, and then it gets harder to talk about, right? Because you're shutting people down. Don't have to fear socialism, I don't think, anymore. One thing this last election, Sanders was not sunk by being called a socialist. They call you one anyway. They call Barack Obama, right? The Affordable Care Act, neoliberal corporatist. Before that, they called Hillary Clinton was always a socialist through all the 90s. So don't be scared to call yourself socialist. They're going to call you one no matter what. And besides, there's this other little technicality. The only possible way to save a livable planet that's going to be inhabitable for great-great-grandchildren and so forth is some form of public ownership and control and direction of our political economy, okay? Without socialism, a type of eco-socialism at this point now, it's over for the human race. Organization is absolutely critical. The main thing missing on the left, and it's been missing on the left since the Communist Party, is through thick and thin organization, a place. The thing about the Communist Party was there was an office somewhere around where you lived, and there were people, and there was a mimeograph machine. The cops came to evict people in Bronzeville, and they said, quick, run and go with the Reds, and they knew where the Reds were. We don't have a definite, absolute organizational presence anywhere. Avoid single issuism. Donald Trump and the Trump administration is avoiding single issuism. It's all the evils. I call it the five evils that are interrelated: capitalism, racism, sexism, militarism, and ecocide, all wrapped up in one ball, all centralized in one ball. We get picked off on just this issue and that issue. We have to fight all of the issues. That said, to wrap up, while I'm against single issuism, I also, and I really am finishing, I do think there is a top issue now. And I think it's interesting that it's the thing that leaps out the most about the Trump administration. It's awful on so many levels, but the main thing that leaps out at me of all the forms of awfulness in the Trump administration is Pruitt, Rex Tillerson, and Rick Perry, and their elaborate plan to undermine every environmental regulation in this country right now. Ecocide, global warming, which is one, the leading, but not the only issue of a whole complex of issues that make up an environmental rift, a many-sided ecological rift. Global warming is the biggest issue, not just of our time, but of any time in human history. It's the biggest issue humanity has ever faced. If environmental catastrophe isn't avoided, and we don't take decisive steps to avoid environmental catastrophe in the next 3 decades. I'm hearing a lot, more and more, about 2030 now. I don't know why, but 2030 keeps coming back to me. Nothing else that we on the left is going to matter all that much. I mean, who wants to more equally slice up a poison pie? Who wants to inherit a cancer-ridden, poisoned planet from the 1%, from the ruling class? We want to turn the world upside down, right? That was the digger's phrase, the height of the English Revolution in the 1640s. But we need to keep a world worth saving and worth inheriting. So I do think amongst our many issues that that is sort of unavoidably, in a very direct materialist kind of way, has emerged as the top issue of our time. And on that, I will wrap it up. Thank you. And we'll take some comments and questions.
The thing about 2030 is real. Yeah. Is that if we don't make significant halts to global warming by then, we're going to see the extermination of humans, plants, and most humans, animals, and most plants by the turn of the century. That's what the latest science is telling us.
By 2100?
Yeah, by 2100. So this is real. I'm going to be talking on this in March. The other thing, though, that I want to bring people's mind to, since Robert mentioned it, is that, yes, I'm on the editorial board, but I just wrote an article for Green Social Thought that proposes a plan for challenging this. One of the things we on the left have been real good is complaining about it, becoming aware of it, that nobody's got a plan for. I put something that's really forward. It's a Green Social Thought. The article starts off with Houston, we have a problem.
Yeah.
It's right, greensocialthought.org if you want to find that. The other thing I want to ask about, now you left... You stepped all around this. You basically said the Dems suck. They have sucked, they will suck forever, et cetera, et cetera. And I happen to agree with that. But you said nothing about, that I got, nothing about how what the left should do, any type of a program. Do we organize? I mean, the question that's going to be, that's out there, is, do we support the Dems continue, or do we just say, screw it, we've got to let it go, we've got to go for a second party, we've got to wipe the Dems out and take a second party? I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, I really, I'm not sure I have a definite answer to that, because it's so damn difficult to get third parties started in this country. It really, you know, I wish there'd be more discussion about rules of the game questions. I guess I'm a crazy outlier in that kind of way, like Dan Lazar and some of these other constitutional writers and theories, that we need to take a hard look at how we actually structure our party system and our electoral system. I've long been an advocate of a democracy amendment. I think there's two democracy amendments that strike me as sort of useful, if nothing else, as organizing tools or discussion points. And one would be a political democracy amendment, and that would involve proportional representation, full public financing of elections, media reform, open debates. I mean, you know, the whole panoply. And there also be an economic democracy amendment too, to follow up on that, in terms of how workplaces are structured, how businesses are structured. You know, if it's going to be just impossible to get a third party started in this country, and if in reality there were to be actual movements towards a democratic socialist movement of the Democratic Party, I mean, I said again and again with all my left critiques of Sanders, I said if it had been Sanders versus Trump in the general election, I would have held my nose. I would have done that. So if you could actually convince me there was the left Democrat, I just don't see that happening anytime soon. It just seems that they had too many of the levers of power. In the meanwhile, I mean, one thing we absolutely know, I mean, I guess I feel like a lot of that stuff about party systems is beyond our sphere of influence. Social movements and the need to build really durable through thick and thin, and now they have to be fundamentally eco-socialist movements, you know? And to some extent, Standing Rock is a symbol and a role model of this. Social movements that can keep the heat on, and that aren't just picked off on single issues, I do think that that's somewhat within leftist sphere of influence to contribute to that and to make that happen. I mean, one of the things about that is, no matter who gets in office, right? You get Democrats in, let's say they get in, Trump screws up and it's horrible, and Cory Booker gets in 2020 or something left of Cory Booker. It's not going to mean a whole hell of a lot without street heat, you know, without pipeline field heat, without workplace heat. I think that that's in our sphere of influence, and I don't know why we don't do more to build a particular unified, non-sectarian left organization to work on and capture those sentiments. I think Mike Halbert tried with the International Organization for a Participatory Society, but for various reasons that didn't go very far. So I wish I had a better answer to that question. And if we were having a real conversation, then you'd come back and I'd come back and we'd come to a dialectical synthesis. But we want to get some other folks in. We should do that privately. Right. Well, it's a complicated question. Yes, sir.
Thanks a lot. So a couple of things struck me. You ended talking about public ownership of money, or at least that's my shorthand, public ownership of banking, or a public economy.
Okay.
And then you were talking about leafleting and being faced with people's lack of interest. And when you're talking about overcoming identity politics, you're talking about appealing to people's self-interest. I put all those together and just ask this question about public banking as a way of organizing. So a century ago in North Dakota, organizing took place around the formation of the public bank. Ellen Brown and Michael Hudson have talked about a public bank as a way of organizing. It seems to me that there's a lot of power there. It's constructive, it's positive, it appeals to things that people can immediately understand. If my money's not being invested on Wall Street, it can go to work in this community. I just want to hear what you have to say.
Well, you know, one of the things we were doing in Iowa City was trying to get tell people that U.S. Bank and Wells Fargo Bank were major investors in the Dakota Access Pipeline, and you don't need to invest in those banks. You can invest in the local community credit unions. And one of the hilarious things about that was that as I got in all these issues with my one of my publishers, who's based in Venezuela, and their latest attempt to get us paid was we had to take payment in euros, and Wells Fargo and U.S. Bank were the only banks that were set up to actually do that. So I'm supposed to have to get an account with the two ones that I've been leafleting against. Now, I mean, you might be aware that the North Dakota State Bank paid something like $4 million to help fund the National Guard and the what's that county up there, to help the militarized police up there. So suppress the pipeline fighters, yeah. And so the public banks can end up being taken over and subordinated to corporate agenda. Of course, they have a right-wing governor up there. The public bank, I imagine they're appointed by the... But yeah, no, as much people can move as much liquidity and social power out of private financial institutions and into public financial institutions. There's just nothing wrong with that at all. Yes, sir.
Yeah, my name is Thomas Flink, and I wanted just
not the author of What's the Matter with Kansas.
No. Oh, okay. Actually, I went to KU with him and everything. We discussed it all the time.
Yeah.
But several things actually. The progressive left ends up in this rhetoric again and again every election cycle of being electoral apologists for peeling off votes off the Democrats. And I really think we need to be bold and say, yes, we took those votes from them, and we're moving forward.
Yeah.
This constant, no, we didn't cause this, is really kind of wimpish. Two other announcements, the Dakota Access.
Yeah.
There is a new front open up, and it's in Illinois. They haven't finished it here in Illinois, and we're going after it just this weekend. And there's going to be another front.
Oh, did you say in Illinois?
You're right here in Illinois.
Oh, good for you. Because
Padoka.
Yeah.
And lastly is
that's interesting.
We organized the Break Free Midwest action in May against the BP refinery here in Lake Michigan, just south of Chicago.
Sure.
And on January 13th, we are going to have a court date. 41 people who got arrested at that event are going to be in court. Several may not take the plea. So we're inviting everybody to come out to Hammond, Indiana, at the Superior Courthouse. It's in downtown Hammond. It's on Friday the 13th. And as many people that can come out to give support,
yeah.
It's going to be a very... fun day.
I think that issue is the issue of our times. There is a wimpishness about that. I noticed Trump didn't mind. And I talk about this chutzpah deficit between left and right. Trump didn't mind talking about if I don't get what I want from the RNC, by God, I'll go off and run by myself. You know, Bernie Sanders didn't want to talk like that. You know, I don't know what that is. The thing about it is, if you got a two-party system, and you only got two damn parties. And it's a winner take nothing, all or nothing system. The only damn way you can make it pose any existential threat to the Democrats, under the system, you're not allowed to pose an existential threat to the Democrats with a third party. The only way you can pose an existential threat to them is to threaten to help elect the Republicans. But I confess to being a little wimpish about that because the Republicans just get so much more fascistic every year after another. That's the problem with that.
Thanks for
your last question or comment.
Thank you very much. I wanted to get your thoughts, or if you could give us your thoughts about some kind of an anti-war movement, and I'm particularly worried about Iran. But just, in general, any specifics, not so much generalities, but about how we could get an anti-war movement going.
Well, I expected Hillary to win, and I thought the first task for the left immediately was going to be to rebuild an anti-war movement because she was going to try and have a confrontation of some kind with Russia. And everybody on anti-war goes to sleep when there's a Democrat in the White House. It's just pathetic. I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, Barack Obama... the drone campaign was the greatest terrorist program in the history of the human race. And And he created more jihad. I mean, Bush had a bigger body count because of Iraq. But the scope of his madness was much more limited. I mean, Obama's all across the Middle East, South Central Asia, and all through Africa. He's militarized Africa. So, so I thought that's what our main task was going to be. Now I think our main task is the environmental issue. But yeah, we're going to have issues. Anyone who thinks they've got a peace president out there is just smoking something. It's what I call Trumpy chumpies. Don't be a Trumpy chumpy. There's all these weird linguistic things happening with, the rise of the Trump and proletariat, which is way oversold. And the rise of the Trumpy chumpies, the left-wing Trumpy chumpies. Give me a break. War president. Give me a war president in all kinds of ways. But I think we really face the issue of combining, the question of how to combine our issues. And you're going to find every military action that he's going to have is going to be intimately related to resource and petroleum issues and global petrocapitalism issues too. It's not pour all your energy into anti-war or environmental issues or defense of black rights or defense of American rights. I think all these things are coming together in important kinds of ways. Dr. King used to talk about there all these issues that we're up against are interwoven and interrelated with each other. Look at the Standing Rock thing. It is race, ethnicity, environmental racism, and fossil fuels, and American capitalism, and global capitalism, and the criminal justice system, and the militarized policing. It's all of them. We're really going to have a left that's all of them. And I keep harping back on the Communist Party. All kinds of issues. Stalinist, all controlled by the Soviet Union. But back in the days of when there was a left, they combined a concern with all the issues, okay, and how they were interconnected with one another.
Will be the concluding remarks.
Okay, all right, okay. Thank you. Thanks all for coming. I really appreciate it.